Chapter 39. Suicides, broken hearts, and broken honor. Only these calamities seemed to have little or no relation to each other, and what the precise curse was that was supposed to connect or account for them, we could not learn. When she first married, my aunt was told nothing about it. Later on in life, when my father asked her for the story, she begged him to talk upon a pleasanter subject. And being unluckily a man of much courtesy and little curiosity, he complied with her request. This, however, was the only part of the ghostly traditions of her husband's home upon which she was so reticent. The haunted chamber, for instance, which, of course, existed at the Grange, she treated with the greatest contempt. Various friends and relations had slept in it at different times, and no approach to any kind of authenticated ghost story, even of the most trivial description, had they been able to supply. Its only claim to respect, indeed, was that it contained the famous Mervyn cabinet, a fascinating puzzle of which I will speak later, but which certainly had nothing haunting or horrible about its appearance. My uncle's family consisted of three sons. The eldest, George, the present baronet, was now in his 30s, married, and with children of his own. The second, Jack, was the black sheep of the family. He had been in the guards, but, about 5 years back, had got into some very disgraceful scrape, and had been obliged to leave the country. The sorrow and the shame of this had killed his unhappy mother, and her husband had not long afterwards followed her to the grave. Alan, the youngest son, probably because he was the nearest to us in age, had been our special favorite in earlier years. George was grown up before I had well left the nursery, and his hot, quick temper had always kept us youngsters somewhat in awe of him. Jack was 4 years older than Alan, and, besides, his profession had, in a way, cut his boyhood short. When my uncle and aunt were abroad, as they frequently were for months together on account of her health, it was Alan, chiefly, who had to spend his holidays with us, both as schoolboy and as undergraduate. And a brighter, sweeter-tempered comrade, or one possessed of more diversified talents for the invention of games or the telling of stories, it would have been difficult to find. For 5 years together now our ancient custom of an annual visit to Mervyn had been broken. First there had been the seclusion of mourning for my aunt, and a year later for my uncle, then George and his wife, Lucy. She was a connection of our own on our mother's side, and very intimate with us all, had been away for nearly 2 years on a voyage round the world, and since then sickness in our own family had kept us in our turn a good deal abroad. So that I had not seen my cousins, since all the calamities which had befallen them in the interval, and as I steamed northwards I wondered a good deal as to the changes I should find. I was to have come out that year in London, but ill health had prevented me, and as a sort of consolation Lucy had kindly asked me to spend a fortnight at Mervyn, and be present at a shooting party, which was to assemble there in the first week of October. I had started early, and there was still an hour of the short autumn day left, when I descended at the little wayside station, from which a 6 mile drive brought me to the Grange. A dreary drive I found at the round, grey, treeless outline of the fells stretching around me on every side beneath the leaden changeless sky. The night had nearly fallen as we drove along the narrow valley in which the Grange stood. It was too dark to see the autumn tints of the woods which clothed and brightened its sides, almost too dark to distinguish the old tower, Dom Alice's tower as it was called, which stood some half a mile farther on at its head. But the light shone brightly from the Grange windows, and all feeling of dreariness departed as I drove up to the door. Leaving maid and boxes to their fate, I ran up the steps into the old, well-remembered hall, and was informed by the dignified man-servant that her ladyship and the tea were awaiting me in the morning room. I found that there was nobody staying in the house except Alan, who was finishing the long vacation there. He had been called to the bar a couple of years before. The guests were not to arrive for another week, so that I had plenty of opportunity in the interval to make up for lost time with my cousins. I began my observations that evening as we sat down to dinner, a cozy party of four. Lucy was quite unchanged, pretty, foolish, and gentle as ever. George showed the full 5 years increase of age, and seemed to have acquired a somewhat painful control of his temper. Instead of the old petulant outbursts, there was at times an air of nervous, irritable self-restraint, which I found the less pleasant of the two. But it was in Alan that the most striking alteration appeared. I felt it the moment I shook hands with him, and the impression deepened that evening with every hour. I told myself that it was only the natural difference between boy and man, between 20 and 25, but I don't think that I believed it. Superficially the change was not great. The slight built, graceful figure, the deep gray eyes, too small for beauty, the clear-cut features, the delicate, sensitive lips, close-shaven now, as they had been hairless then, all were as I remembered them. But the face was paler and thinner than it had been, and there were lines round the eyes, and at the corners of the mouth which were no more natural to 25 than they would have been to 20. The old charm, indeed the sweet friendliness of manner, which was his own peculiar possession, was still there. He talked and laughed almost as much as formerly, but the talk was manufactured for our entertainment, and the laughter came from his head, and not from his heart. And it was when he was taking no part in the conversation that the change showed most. Then the face, on which in the old time every passing emotion had expressed itself in a constant, living current, became cold and impassive, without interest, and without desire. It was at such times that I knew most certainly that here was something which had been living and was dead. Was it only his boyhood? This question I was unable to answer. Still, in spite of all, that week was one of the happiest in my life. The brothers were both men of enough ability and cultivation to be pleasant talkers, and Lucy could perform adequately the part of conversational accompanist, which, socially speaking, is all that is required of a woman. The meals and evenings passed quickly and agreeably. The mornings I spent in unending gossips with Lucy, or in games with the children, two bright boys of 5 and 6 years old. But the afternoons were the best part of the day. George was a thorough squire in all his tastes and habits, and every afternoon his wife dutifully accompanied him round farms and coverts, inspecting new buildings, trudging along half-made roads, or marking unoffending trees for destruction. Then Alan and I would ride by the hour together over moor and meadowland, often picking our way homewards down the glenside long after the autumn evenings had closed in. During these rides I had glimpses many a time into depths in Alan's nature of which I doubt whether in the old days he had himself been aware. To me certainly they were as a revelation. A prevailing sadness, occasionally a painful tone of bitterness, characterized these more serious moods of his, but I do not think that, at the end of that week, I would, if I could, have changed the man whom I was learning to revere and to pity, for the light-hearted playmate whom I felt was lost to me forever. 2. The only feature of the family life which jarred on me was the attitude of the two brothers towards the children. I did not notice this much at first, and at all times it was a thing to be felt, rather than to be seen. George himself never seemed quite at ease with them. The boys were strong and well-grown, healthy in mind and body, and one would have thought that the existence of two such representatives, to carry on his name and inherit his fortune, would have been the very crown of pride and happiness to their father. But it was not so. Lucy indeed was devoted to them, and in all practical matters, no one could have been kinder to them than was George. They were free of the whole house, and every indulgence that money could buy for them they had. I never heard him give them a harsh word. But there was something wrong. A constraint in their presence, a relief in their absence, an evident dislike of discussing them and their affairs, a total want of that enjoyment of love and possession which in such a case one might have expected to find. Alan's state of mind was even more marked. Never did I hear him willingly address his nephews, or in any way allude to their existence. I should have said that he simply ignored it, but for the heavy gloom which always overspread his spirits in their company, and for the glances which he would now and again cast in their direction, glances full of some hidden painful emotion, though of what nature it would have been hard to define. Indeed, Ellen's attitude towards her children I soon found to be the only source of friction between Lucy and this otherwise much loved member of her husband's family. I asked her one day why the boys never appeared at luncheon. "Oh, they come when Ellen is away," she answered. "But they seem to annoy him so much that George thinks it is better to keep them out of sight when he is here. It is very tiresome. I know that it is the fashion to say that George has got the temper of the family, but I assure you that Ellen's nervous moods and fancies are much more difficult to live with." That was on the morning, a Friday. It was of the last day which we were to spend alone. The guests were to arrive soon after tea, and I think that with the knowledge of their approach, Ellen and I prolonged our ride that afternoon beyond its usual limits. We were on our way home, and it was already dusk, when a turn of the path brought us face to face with the old ruined tower, of which I have already spoken as standing at the head of the valley. I had not been close up to it yet during this visit at Mervyn. It had been a very favorite haunt of ours as children, and partly on that account, partly perhaps in order to defer the dreaded close of our ride to the last possible moment, I proposed an inspection of it. The only portion of the old building left standing in any kind of entirety was two rooms, one above the other. The tower room, level with the bottom of the moat, was dark and damp, and it was the upper one, reached by a little outside staircase, which had been our rendezvous of old. Ellen showed no disposition to enter, and said that he would stay outside and hold my horse, so I dismounted and ran up alone. The room seemed in no way changed. A mere stone shell, littered with fragments of wood and mortar. There was the rough wooden block on which Ellen used to sit, while he first frightened us with bogey stories, and then calmed our excited nerves by rapid sallies of wild nonsense. There was the plank from behind which, erected as a barrier across the doorway, he would defend the castle against our united assault, pelting us with fir cones and sods of earth. This and many a bygone scene thronged on me as I stood there, and the room filled again with the memories of childish mirth. And following close came those of childish terrors. Horrors which had oppressed me then, wholly imagined or dimly apprehended from half-heard traditions, and never thought of since, flitted around me in the gathering dusk. And with them, it seemed to me, as if there came other memories too, memories which had never been my own, of scenes whose actors had long been with the dead, but which, immortal as the spirit before whose eyes they had dwelt, still lingered in the spot where their victim had first learned to shudder at their presence. Once the ghastly notion came to me, it seized on my imagination with irresistible force. It seemed as if from the darkened corners of the room vague, ill-defined shapes were actually peering out at me. When night came they would show themselves in that form, livid and terrible, in which they had been burned into the brain and heart of the long ago dead. I turned and glanced towards where I had left Ellen. I could see his figure framed in by the window, a black shadow against the gray twilight of the sky behind. Erect and perfectly motionless he sat, so motionless as to look almost lifeless, gazing before him down the valley into the illimitable distance beyond. There was something in that stern immobility of look and attitude which struck me with a curious sense of congruity. It was right that he should be thus, right that he should be no longer the laughing boy who a moment before had been in my memory. The haunting horrors of that place seemed to demand it, and for the first time I felt that I understood the change. With an effort I shook myself free from these fancies, and turned to go. As I did so, my eye fell upon a queer-shaped painted board, leaning up against the wall, which I well recollected in old times. Many a discussion had we had about the legend inscribed upon it, which in our wisdom we had finally pronounced to be German, chiefly because it was illegible. Though I had loudly professed my faith in this theory at the time, I had always had uneasy doubts on the subject, and now half smiling I bent down to verify or remove them. The language was English, not German, but the badly painted, faded Gothic letters in which it was written made the mistake excusable. In the dim light I had difficulty even now in deciphering the words, and felt when I had done, so that neither the information conveyed, nor the style of the composition, was sufficient reward for the trouble I had taken. This is what I read. Where the woman sinned, the maid shall win, but God help the maid that sleeps within. What the lines could refer to I neither had any notion, nor did I pause then even in my own mind to inquire. I only remember vaguely wondering whether they were intended for a tombstone or for a doorway. Then, continuing my way, I rapidly descended the steps and remounted my horse, glad to find myself once again in the open air and by my cousin's side. The train of thought into which he had sunk during my absence was apparently an absorbing one, for to my first question as to the painted board he could hardly rouse himself to answer. A board with a legend written on it? Yes, he remembered something of the kind there. It had always been there, he thought. He knew nothing about it, and so the subject was not continued. The weird feelings which had haunted me in the tower still oppressed me, and I proceeded to ask Alan about that old Dom Alice whom the traditions of my childhood represented as the last occupant of the ruined building. Alan roused himself now, but did not seem anxious to impart information on the subject. She had lived there, he admitted, and no one had lived there since. Had she not, I inquired, something to do with the mysterious cabinet at the house? I remember hearing it spoken of as Dame Alice's cabinet. Apostrophe, so they say, he assented. She and an Italian artificer who was in her service, and who, chiefly I imagine on account of his skill, shared with her the honor of reputed witchcraft. She was the mother of Hugh Mervyn, the man who was murdered by his wife, was she not? I asked. Yes, said Alan, briefly. And had she not something to do with the curse? I inquired after a short pause, and nervously I remembered my father's experience on that subject, and I had never before dared to allude to it in the presence of any member of the family. My nervousness was fully warranted. The gloom on Alan's brow deepened, and after a very short they say, so he turned full upon me, and inquired with some asperity why on earth I had developed this sudden curiosity about his ancestress. I hesitated a moment, for I was a little ashamed of my fancies, but the darkness gave me courage, and besides I was not afraid of telling Alan he would understand. I told him of the strange sensations I had had while in the tower, sensations which had struck me with all that force and clearness which we usually associate with a direct experience of fact. Of course it was a trick of imagination, I commented, but I could not get rid of the feeling that the person who had dwelt there last must have had terrible thoughts for the companions of her life. Alan listened in silence, and the silence continued for some time after I had ceased speaking. It is strange, he said at last. Instincts which we do not understand form the motive power of most of our life's actions, and yet we refuse to admit them as evidence of any external truth. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.